Pushkin.
My name is Malcolm Gladwell. Welcome to Broken Record. Today on the show, he's called the greatest songwriter alive by Elton John, no less, Rufus Wainwright. The writer and performer has transformed his love of pop, cabaret, and even opera into a series of extraordinary albums. They explore his own life and the world around him, from his sexuality to his famous musical family. Rufus sat down with Bruce Headlam at Sunset Sound in Hollywood just 4 days after he premiered his latest opera, Hadrian, in Toronto, and just as he was preparing for a new tour. He showed up at the studio with his guitar, a beat-up Gibson acoustic, and a terrible cold. But Rufus with a cold is better than most of us healthy. Before we play his interview with Bruce, I just want you to hear Rufus playing one of his gorgeous songs at the studio's piano.
The yellow walls are lined with portraits, and I got my new red fetching leather jacket. All these poses, such beautiful poses, makes any boy feel like picking up roses. There's never been such grave a matter as come wearing our new brand name black sunglasses. All these poses, such beautiful poses, makes any boy feel as pretty as princes. The green autumnal box conducting and the city streets are wondrous chorus singing. All these poses, oh, how can you blame me? Life is a game and true love is a trophy and you say. Reclined amongst these packs of reasons for to smoke the days away into the evenings. All these poses of classical torture ruin my mind like a snake in the orchard. I did go from wanting to be someone, now I'm drunk and wearing flip-flops on Fifth Avenue. Once you've fallen from classical virtue, won't have a soul but to wake up and hold you in the green autumnal park conducting. All the city streets are wondrous chorus singing. All these poses, now no longer boyish, made me a man. Ah, but who cares what that is? And you said, watch my
watch my head.
Was wonderful.
Thank you.
First thing I'll say, what did that song come out of?
That song came out of, I was living at the Chelsea Hotel, and I had had, you know, it's funny because I went to New York earlier on, before my first record. You know, my dad had always, Loudon Wainwright the Third, you know, he'd always lived in New York. And so I went down there and, you know, slummed around and really had a terrible time. Nobody got me. It was at the time that Jeff Buckley was on the rise, and I'd go to this place, Shanae's, in the Lower East Side, and I gave them my tape three times. They refused it three times. They gave it back to me three times, and just New York did not embrace me at all. And so I left, and then I ended up coming to Hollywood and doing it there and making my first record. Anyways, so then I came back to New York having made a record and being, you know, being well known and sort of the hot new guy on the block. And of course, everybody loved me. Everybody wanted to have a piece of me. Everybody, you know, I was suddenly king of the city. And that's when I wrote Poses. At that point, I went into my New York. I was like, I'm going to have my New York experience. And so I moved into the Chelsea and proceeded to debaucherize mm-hmm. my existence and that song and Cigarettes and Chocolate Milk. Those two came mm-hmm. out of that.
Are there traces of your? I mean, of course, there's traces of your mother in what you do, but her musical influences in what you do.
Yeah, I mean, my mother Kate would play piano all the time. She listened to records a lot. And had incredibly high taste for artists. I mean, she loved, of course, you know, all the great blues players like Blind Willie Johnson, and she loved the Rolling Stones. They, of course, were all obsessed with Dylan. They loved all the Field recordings, you know, the Harry Smith recordings, or they'd listen to, you know, Mahler's Fifth Symphony. I mean, it was a high-end music environment. So my mother would play the Goldberg Variations every morning, parts of them, not the most complicated ones, but, you know, so there was a lot of Glenn Gould and there was a lot of stuff like that. So, yeah, she was just a fountain of musical curiosity.
Okay. Did your father's songwriting influence you?
Yeah, I mean, my dad, I didn't see a lot of my father growing up. He was touring a lot, and he and my mom didn't really get along. So I didn't see him so much. But mostly when I saw him, it was in the context of a concert or show. So I saw him on stage. I probably related to him more as a person while watching him perform than as I did as a person or as a father, you know, living. And that was not hard to do because his work is so confessional, and that's sort of really where he became who he really is. And it was where I could get a lot of the answers to my questions concerning the family, concerning his inner thoughts and desires and fears. So going to see his shows was always a real education on so many levels, whether it was about songwriting or just, you know, what was going on in my life.
It's not only a musical family, but you're a family that tends to, I don't know if you work out your issues, but you certainly address your issues in song.
Yes.
What's that, first of all, where does that impulse come from?
Yeah. Well, I mean, arguably it started with my grandfather on my father's side, with Loudon Wainwright II. He was a very well-known writer for Life magazine, had a column for years called The View from Here, which was incredibly popular in the 60s, you know, and Life magazine was, you know, the be-all and end-all of American culture. So he would write about his kids and write about his dog and write about Kennedy or write about, you know, his relationship to, you know, the moon landing or something. So it was that's how that thing was set up. So on my father's side. With my mom, I think, you know, she got into folk music. And she was obviously quite talented. And she came from a generation of singers, too, that I'm finding out now, though they were more kind of vaudevillian. But I think when she came to, you know, the Philadelphia Folk Festival in the 60s and stuff, you know, and Bob Dylan was around, and it was the thing to do, you know, to really bare your soul and be truthful and kind of live your life through music. So all of that kind of collided.
Is it strange to revisit those songs now?
My mother's songs or my father's songs?
No,
or?
But even your songs, yeah. Dinner at Eight or other songs you've written.
Yeah.
You know, you wrote a song to your sister about your mother being sick. Yeah. Very personal.
Yeah. I mean, I singing my songs is kind of my day job. I mean, I have to do shows every month. You know, 3 or 4 shows at least, just to maintain my existence financially. And I, believe me, I do not have the luxury to kind of, you know, pick and choose what to present. I have to go with what works. And thankfully, you know, over my the crest of my career, there have been many periods that I can borrow from. And so I'm constantly going in and out of those worlds, and there's songs that there are many songs I sing now from my first records, and yeah, so it's not weird to me at all. Look, a good song is a good song, and I'll just, you know, and an audience deserves that.
You gave me all your love in one day. You gave it all and almost faded away. Well, I'm gonna take this sad, unread issue in my arms tonight. Looking at hospitals, Victoria, feeling as helpless as the elephant man. Wish you were here to chain you up without shame. In my arms tonight. So if you should feel a bit out of place, take this sad, unread hospital's Victorian, feeling as helpless as the elephant man. Wish you were here to change you up without shame. In my arms tonight, I ain't a soft and saccharine wannabe. Still, I pray to God there's somewhere in Napoli. So I offer you a place to rest and forget yourself. Still, I pray to God there's somewhere in Napoli. So I offer you a place to rest and forget yourself in my arms. Yourself in my arms. Yourself. Yourself in my arms tonight.
Back after this, with more from Bruce Hedlum and Rufus Wainwright. We're back with Bruce Hedlum in conversation with Rufus Wainwright.
Tell me where In My Arms came from.
Well, that came from, I was living in Montreal, Quebec, and, you know, I had gone to McGill for 2 seconds. I was there for about a year, maybe even a year and a half. Before that, I'd been in boarding school in upstate New York at the Millbrook School. And when I arrived back in Montreal, where I'd grown up previously, I was really excited to sort of dive into the hedonistic, I should say, society that city can offer, and ended up at McGill and was shocked by how boring it was and uptight and full of truly staid characters. I hate to say it really was. And I can say that now because I work in the classical music world now and writing operas. So I have a deep appreciation for musicians of that ilk. But at that time in my life, it was just not what I was looking for. I wanted to party my brains out and hang out with, the demi-monde. So I dropped out of McGill and ended up, hanging out a lot on St. Lawrence Street and going to, there was a couple of bars there. One was called the Biftec and one was called Miami. And I kind of gravitated towards those two. And that was where all the street urchins hung out. And one of them was this boy whose name I can't remember, who, I just had this brief, very brief affair with, and he ended up sadly committing suicide. And that song was about him. Hmm. So it was,
How did it come about musically?
I grew up, at that point I was living with my mom, and she, Kate McGarrigle of the McGarrigle sisters, in my opinion, aside from being my mom, I think was also one of the greatest talents of her or any other generation in terms of songwriting. I mean, both Kate and my Aunt Anna wrote some of the most perfect music of the 70s and 80s and 90s even. And Kate was very cognizant of my desire to follow in the family footsteps and do music and become a songwriter. So she really impressed upon me that I had to, you know, gather as many experiences as possible. She told me explicitly to never get a job. She said, don't ever get a job. And she ended up giving me an allowance, which was not a lot. It was like $10 a week, yeah. Which, believe it or not, in those days you could actually, if you were living with your parents, you could actually do quite well on $10 a week. So I was allowed to be in that mode and at a very young age. And even though at times I'm sure my mother was horrified by what I was going through and what I was coming into contact with, I think she always knew deep down that it was a sort of artistic pursuit and that it was as a songwriter, it's kind of where I had to go.
Mm-hmm. Do you write every day? Did you write every day then?
At that point in my life, I was completely ravenous with musical hunger and would write every day and sometimes spend, you know, 5 or 6 hours at the piano just losing myself in it. And that had started earlier in boarding school, where I would just, there was a chapel in our school and I would go there for a long time. I spent a lot of time in church, not praying, but sort of praying in a way. So yeah, no, I worked a lot. And yeah, which you have to do.
Was it always at the piano in those days?
Mostly at the piano, though I incorporated the guitar pretty early on, because one of the main things that I knew intrinsically was that I had to perform as much as possible in front of an audience, and not everybody had a piano, so a guitar was a much easier way to kind of move your product along. So I started writing songs on the guitar. Mm-hmm.
Did the melody come with the lyric in many cases?
In the best cases, it happened simultaneously. And then, you know, the melody often really completes itself holistically without, you know, much help. But, and then you have to kind of grind away at the lyrics afterwards to kind of keep up. So, yeah, words are much harder than music.
You say the melody completes itself, but you are known for, you have much longer melodies than most pop songs.
Yeah.
Where does that come from? Where does the...
Well, a lot of that comes from my love of opera. I, at the age of 13, was... Well, at the age of 12, I was a normal kid, vaguely normal. But then at 13, I came into contact with this recording of Verdi's Requiem with Leontine Price and UC Burling, And after a two-hour stint of listening to that from top to bottom, I was utterly, changed and turned into this 75-year-old opera queen in front of my horrified parents' faces. And it's interesting because, you know, now my operas are produced and you know, we just premiered Hadrian and with the COC in Toronto and. Which was a big, great success, and I have, and that's my second opera, so it's now a big part of my life. But I knew back then even that though, you know, whether I wrote one or not, I kind of knew I'd never be an opera singer. But whether I composed one or not, I definitely had the sense that there were so many interesting tricks and sensibilities and structures in arias that I could then incorporate into my own popular material, and that I'd sort of discovered this treasure trove or Aladdin's cave that nobody else knew about, and that I could then, you know, translate. And that was, I was right in that case. I mean, you know, nobody, once I really hit the scene officially, you know, in Los Angeles with my first album, people really had never heard anything quite like what I'd created. I don't give opera the full credit necessarily, but opera was a big component mm-hmm. of that.
Were there times you were literally translating something you'd heard in an opera to a pop song, or was it just more the kind of lines?
I ripped off a couple of things a few times, but I think it was more just the structure of a song where there should be a kind of climax that occurs, and then, you know, a denouement after that. You know, there's a lot of my bridges kind of go into these very unusual places, and it was more that sensibility of really the aria or the song dominating the listener and making them follow them and not the other way around. You know, it was never kind of background music.
Do you separate writing melodies in your mind when you're writing opera? I don't want to
go
too far ahead, but there's certainly, I'm thinking of maybe the first aria in your first opera in Prima Donna.
Yeah, yeah.
That could very much be a pop song that you wrote. Before you heard the Requiem, was there a pop song that, that kind of crystallized it for you?
Yeah, I was, I mean, what I also like to point out is that before opera, I was heavily into pop music, and it was a glorious period. You know, from my, from about the age of 7 until 13, it was, you know, the Eurythmics, Cyndi Lauper, Prince, Tina Turner. I was really into the Thompson Twins, Blondie, you know, and stuff. So, you know, once in the mid-80s when it started to get a little more, or the late-80s, you know, around, you know, I don't like to put down people, but, you know, like Huey Lewis and the News, which, you know, I think in retrospect, you kind of look at their stuff and you're like, it was kind of amazing. But it was, it got a little it just got a little heteronormative at a certain point, for me especially. Right. And then the whole grunge thing happened, which was simultaneous to my opera phase. And I think, oddly enough, you know, the opera, my love for opera was a similar kind of desire that, that a lot of kids had when they got into Kurt Cobain and stuff. It was this desire for, you know, a certain darkness that that the world needed at that point.
Mm-hmm. And you said personally you were around 14 at that point.
Yeah.
You'd come out.
Well, I'd come out to myself. I mean, I hadn't come out to anyone officially, but I knew I was gay. I was engaged in, you know, sexual things. I was all, and AIDS was decimating, you know, the world around me, and I had to go to boarding school at that point.
So what was the appeal of opera at that particular point, beyond the, the music that you loved, that you talked about, the
darkness.
Well,
it was. And
the drama.
I mean, it was. It really spoke to the darkness that was surrounding me. And you know, I had sex first when I was around 13, around that time, and that I started, you know, listening to opera. And I thought for a good 10 years that I was going to die. And honestly, and in retrospect, there was a very good chance that could have happened, you know. Every pimple, every, you know, scrape suddenly was Kaposi's sarcoma. You know, it was this, you know, real trauma that opera thrives off of, you know. And so I got a lot of solace from that and a lot of answers, you know, in terms of, you know, the bigger questions and, you know, and what really matters and, you know, the power of love and the power of forgiveness and the power of transcendence, which opera always does. So I do think also that there are these opera gods and there's this kind of spiritual realm where opera resides, and that those ghosts kind of chose me as well. Like there was, it was like the art form came to me and was like, we want you to do our bidding in a very spooky kind of way. Cause I've had experiences like that with opera since then, where it's very, very, there's a supernatural quality to that music that that I wholly believe in. You know, like people believe in Jesus Christ or, you know, stuff like that. I believe in opera in that way.
Do you believe that of other music? Have there been other kinds of music or songs that have changed the way maybe you've written?
No, I mean, I view all other music as kind of as beautiful and fascinating and magical, but not opera is like a religion for me. That you know, it helped me at that point. It also helped me greatly down the line when I was struggling with drugs and alcohol, and then it also helped me when my mother was dying, and I'm sure it'll help me, you know, in future disasters.
If there's any that will help you get through this interview, you know, just feel free to put it on.
Rufus Wainwright and Bruce Headlam back after this. We're back with Bruce and Rufus.
This is just called My Little You. So it's about Viva. Here we go.
You were thought of in the dressing room of La Divina, where your parents spent too much time in front of the mirror. In the Conservatorio Musicale Luigi Cherubini, my little you. Daddy putting on his makeup and wearing black feathers. Mama wading through the river Styx with all the answers.
Song sort of addressed to my daughter Viva, and I think it's going to make it on the new record.
And she's how old now?
She's 7.5. Mm-hmm. There's a requirement in my family at this point, with both Viva and Jorn, my husband, who basically have stated that the rule is I have to have one song about them on each record. So it's my quota, kind of.
Do you do more than one?
Well, I've written about three songs about Viva and three about him.
Okay.
Regardless, but
was Respectable Dive about him?
Yes, Respectable Dive was about our relationship for sure. But this latest one is a short little ditty about Viva. So. Or directed towards Viva.
Okay. Beyond the contractual requirement you have in your family.
Yes.
To write about.
Yeah.
What prompted the song?
Well, you know, I just wanted to write a little something. You know, Viva was born under very unusual circumstances, you know, which at this point is not unusual. I mean, we're living in this amorphous world, obviously, that's changing so quickly, and you know, there's the common traditional family construct is shifting, and Viva is really on the front lines of that, you know, because you know her mother and I aren't together as a couple, and I'm gay, and I have a husband, and she loves him and she loves me, so it's just to sort of frame that a little bit for her, the explanation of that, in a very whimsical way. And also because I think it's a fascinating story in a lot of ways, how she was brought about. She definitely wanted to. She definitely is meant to be here. I can tell you that emphatically.
Mm-hmm. Contracts were signed.
Well, no. I mean, I think it's more. You know, you really. What's fascinating with kids, and I don't think that when parents were in more traditional positions, that they could maybe grasp this as well as parents can now, who are now, you know, have all these choices, they realize how much it's really the kid that has made the decision to arrive. You know, because once that person is in your life, it really fits into where you need to be and what you need to be doing and how you need to adjust your existence to cater to this new soul. And I think a lot of that was taken for granted when there weren't these other avenues available. And now that there's, you know, all these different types of families and kids are, you know, brought up by all different types of people, it's just the kids know, you know, they made this, that choice. It's that thing of the kids choosing the parents as opposed to the parents choosing the kid. I think that is very powerfully proven in this era.
I have two young kids, and it is incredible how they basically drive the agenda.
Yeah, no, they totally at some do. Point. I have amazing faith in young people and children of this time, and really feel like, in a lot of ways, sadly, that it's, though, you know, though my parents' generation, my generation, I don't know what the hell we're doing, but my parents' generation was so dominant and is now, you know, with Trump obviously kind of hard to knock out. but the younger generation, the kids, my daughter and so forth, they're going to figure this out, I think. Mm.
I've heard you do a lot of Leonard Cohen songs, yes. And there's a connection to your daughter there.
Yes, and he is the grandfather of my daughter.
Did you know him in Montreal?
I didn't know him in Montreal at all. I mean, I knew him in L.A. Mm-hmm. I didn't know, I mean, I met Lorca once, the daughter, his daughter, when I was in Montreal, mm-hmm. very briefly. But then it was really when I came to California that
What was your relationship with him?
Well, you know, we had a really interesting relationship. I mean, I would in no way pretend to be a good friend of his. We were definitely bound by something. I mean, there was a kind of acceptance. He had an acceptance of me that I think was very rare, but not at all open either. You know, it wasn't. I don't think he tolerated me necessarily, but he knew I was going to stick around, and he. He made some room for me, you know, in his world. And then when things, you know, picked up and later on and we, you know, Lorca and I decided to have a child, he was, I think he was very happy about that. And sadly, you know, his health declined soon after Viva was born. But they got to spend a lot of time together. You know, they actually kind of all lived together. So, I mean, my favorite Leonard thing that impressed me and that I'll always remember him for is that, you know, when my first opera was produced, there was a New Yorker that came out, New Yorker magazine, and there was a big advertisement for it, for the New York City Opera. And on one page was Prima Donna, and on the other page was La Traviata. Now, Leonard had always been, you know, I think he liked my music. I think he appreciated my talent. I think he respected me greatly, but he wasn't at all effusive or, you know, he didn't come to my shows or anything like that. But when that New Yorker came out and he saw the two, you know, operas, one next to each other, he came down and he kind of grabbed me and he said, you know, Rufus, this is really amazing. I am so impressed by that. And I could tell deep down he was impressed and proud of me, you know, for mm-hmm. doing that. Because I think it was something that he could have never done, you know, and it was something that it was like a whole other universe that he certainly had a lot of respect for, but that also didn't necessarily, you know, encroach on his territory. So, but he was, and that was a great comfort to me and a great sort of impetus to continue.
Yeah. Did he... Did his songwriting influence yours at all?
I think his, I don't know if his style, musical style necessarily influenced me too much. I would say, you know, his lyrics are second to none, obviously. And I've often hoped that there might be, you know, a glimmer of similarity here and there in some of my lines. I do think the way I write is completely different. I think he's far superior, in that department. But I've always kept him as a beacon, you know, for in terms of words, mm-hmm. Someone to, you know, keep in the back of your mind.
I do want to talk about one more song, and this is called The Sword of Damocles.
Yes, yes.
Tell me about that song.
Yeah, well, I've been hanging out quite a bit with Carrie Fisher before she died. And before she went to London, I was at her house, and, you know, it was a nutty period. And she was on the phone with her attorney, screaming at him, talking about how she felt like the sword of Damocles was over her head. And it just resonated that saying. And that just sort of started rolling around in my subconscious. And I just started writing this song about Damocles. And then during the writing of it, I realized that, that's when, Trump won the election. I hadn't finished it yet. So it was one of these kind of, there was an ominous quality, you know, mm-hmm. to this song. And also, you know, Carrie sadly passed away right before the election, or maybe it was right after, but it was around that period. And so there was just this dark spirit roaming that my songwriting instincts were picking up on, and it had to do with Damocles. And then I didn't actually know the story, so then I thought, you know, it might be good to actually know what I'm writing about. So I Googled Damocles and learned the story by Cicero, which is actually about, you know, a king who is being courted by one of his subjects, Damocles, and Damocles is saying, oh, it must be wonderful to be king. And then, you know, they switch places mystically, and Damocles is then the king, but he notices that there's this sword over his head, and the idea is that with, you know, great power comes great responsibility and also great danger. So then I finished the song with having known the actual myth, and also after, you know, Trump had been elected president, and it just sort of all fit, sadly, very well. And what I'll say about Damocles, though, about this song, is that it's not only, and I think this is important to point out, is that in the song, I, for instance, at the end of it, I say, you know, I am a tyrant, meaning that, you know, when the sword of Damocles falls, it's on all of us, you know, and it's not really, and it should fall, it needs to happen, but it's going to really devastate everyone. And I think we're just preparing for it right now. But we will hopefully prevail. And that's when I go to the younger generation and I realize that they do seem ready to fight.
That was Rufus Wainwright in conversation with Bruce Hedlund. We'll leave you today with Rufus Wainwright's new single, Sword of Damocles.
Raise cup.
Broken Record is produced by Mia LaBelle and Jason Gambrell, with help from Bruce Headlam, Chiquita Pascal, Jacob Smith, Julia Barton, Justin Richmond, Jacob Weisberg, and of course, El Jefe, Rick Rubin. Our Broken Record theme music is by Evan Viola. To hear all of the songs featured in today's episode, check out BrokenRecordPodcast.com. This show is brought to you by Pushkin Industries. I'm Malcolm Gladwell. When I was growing up, my father dubbed our garden cart Rufus. So every time I see Rufus Wainwright, I think of the garden cart. By the way, Pushkin was the name of our first dog. That's where that comes from.